Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
What's up, everybody? How you doing out there? Now, I gotta tell you, I'm doing pretty good right now. Festival season is in full swing, and I have got one hell of a podcast for you today. My man Goldie joined me for a live podcast in London last week, and when you've had a career as long and as varied as this guy, you've got stories for days. G just dropped his new album called Journeyman, which is amazing, by the way. You need to check it if you haven't already. You got to get that one in your collection. It's an amalgamation of all the things that are Goldie. And in the pod, he goes right back to the start, talking about when he was doing graffiti in Wolverhampton, his first trip to New York City, and his first experience painting on a train. We talk about parties we went to at Nelly Hooper's house, and Goldie takes us right through his musical career, including the catharsis he experienced creating Mother, up to the present day. Now, he's an avid hot yoga practitioner and lives in an idyllic home he built with his wife in Thailand. He even does a demonstration of the posture he finds most difficult. It's called the Shavasana, or Dead Man's Pose, he told me it's called. That was a great piece of podcasting right there. Goldie just laying on the floor in front of a live audience. For all you Goldie fans out there, you won't need me to tell you that he's a true showman. This episode does not fail to deliver it, and it comes in two parts, so you'll have even more to look forward to later this week. So, yos, as always, if you enjoy this episode, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe on the Acast or the iTunes, and tell your friends, spread the love, it's the Brooklyn way. So here it is, drum and bass legend, my man Goldie in conversation, live on Huey Off the Record. And it's the first voice you'll hear is my producer, Joe, giving a shout-out to some lucky winners who entered the competition to get tickets to the live event. She's a G.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for being here. I'm Joe. I am the producer of Huey Off the Record. It's really amazing that we've got you all here in this incredible space. Thank you to all of you who entered. We had some incredible music suggestions for your most inspiring songs. I'm going to call a few of you out. I didn't give you the heads up on this, so don't be shy. So we had Rash Paul. Where are you? There you are, young man in the front. Yeah, you sent us about 10 songs, and that tactic worked. That tactic totally worked. But you did get picked for Gonna Fly Now by Bill Conti, which is the Rocky theme. So that was the one. That was the one that tipped it over the edge. Yeah, yeah. And we have Amanda, lovely lady sitting in the front row here, with Straight Outta Compton. Badass. Yeah, that's kicked off her clubbing days. Diane, where's the lovely Diane? Here we are. David Bowie, Heroes, classic, always. Dan, where? Ooh, Child. The five stair steps. Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of left field, but we like that one. Yeah. And Gary. I mean, it would have been rude not to. Goldie, Timeless. He specified the 20-minute version. Yeah, it worked, though. It worked. Yeah. Yeah, you're good with those tactics. Well done. Okay, so we just want to say a massive thank you to Novotel, who have sponsored this podcast and made it all possible. Gifted us this incredible venue. For those of you who are listening on the recording, we are all looking at this beautiful view over London. We are... We're all feeling very wealthy right now. So we are at the Novotel London Canary Wharf, and this is the new flagship Novotel. And I think we can all agree this is a pretty damn cool hotel, right? This is an amazing space to be in. So mad props to Novotel. Thank you so much for making this all possible. And without further ado, let's get into it. We have everybody's favorite fun-loving criminal, Mr. Huey Morgan, and drum and bass legend Goldie, everybody. Give it up. Oh, yeah.
Yes, it's good.
So this is kind
of. I'm gonna fake this mic, so I'm not holding your mic. I'm holding my own.
I think you can. Do I have? Yeah, you have a stand. You can just put it there. I gotta do hostess with the mostest.
There you go. Now you can hear me, peoples.
All right, so apparently these aren't going through a PA, which is kind of shit for us because we'll beatbox and it just sounds
like it's fine. I got this. As long as you can all hear me at the back, you might want to come up a little bit. I'm not sure if you want to do that. It's like, it's raconteering.
No, like, nah,
this is raconteering. It's raconteering at its finest. Yeah. The good view. No longer the campfire your granddad built or something. It's a, you know, a big view.
Well, yeah, indeed. I think this is kind of cool. I've never talked... I have actually talked shit in front of people like this. We were talking about the...
We were saying that this is both basically like when we used to get off our tits in the 90s and, you know, we'd be in a bar, but it's the kind of cleansing, you know, the cleansing version of that.
Yeah.
So like we're at the yayo.
At Nelly Hooper's house or
something. Yeah, yeah, the party. Oh, God. You went there. We all went there. My eye's going. Is my eye going? Yeah, there were some very infamous moments, really, Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it was a bit of a blur.
Yeah. Yeah, but we did talk shit to probably this amount of people. Given times,
yeah, and of course we get pulled up at a cheese counter in Waitrose saying, "Do you remember that party? I'm trying to buy cheese." Do you know what I mean? Yeah, so that's kind of strange.
That's
really
very true. Now I wanted to ask you first of all, thank you for coming on the podcast. Normally, like I said, we do it in the privacy of just wherever we'd hang out. But considering that y'all are here, I know there's some questions y'all want to ask, and we're going to get some Q&A a little bit later. Yeah. But I wanted to ask you right off the bat: when I first met you, all we talked about for like the first 5-6 times was New York City.
Yeah.
Right? So tell me about how you got into New York City, because it's a great story, man.
I always knew I was an artist. I was always getting pens and stealing markers from somewhere. This is before graffiti kind of happened. And then, you know, we were breakdancing and getting into the whole culture of hip hop. It just hit us really hard. You know, we'd see it on daytime TV and... You know, we got this book and it was Subway Art, and I opened it up and saw these trains and it just blew my mind. You know, that this art was being painted by a set of people. At that time I was thought, just these guys from New York, but it was culturally, you know, Hispanic, Puerto Rican, Cuban, Afro-American. And it blew my mind that, you know, I look back on that and what happened, we were breakdancing, this kid called Brim Fuentes came to the Shaw Theatre in London to do a workshop on graffiti. And it was Cookie Crew and some of the London guys, and he came down and Bambaataa was there with him. And we made it like a trip in a Volkswagen minibus to London to the Shaw Theatre, you know. And then in the daytime, we came down in the morning, we were going to Lilywatch trying to find a Kangol in the sports department. We can find Kangols here, you know.
It's London,
Believe me, you'd go to our... You'd have all these kind of like really messed up, could I say fucked up people walking coming into an haberdashery store, you know, trying to find like thick enough ribbon to put in your sneakers so it looked cool, you know? And, you know, started stealing lots of golf apparel because it was cool, you know? And we did that. I went to Common Garden. There was a few kind of dances that happened. And then Nelly and all those guys, well, basically what happened was Brim kind of liked me. He just took a liking to me. He said, "Yo, we got to get him in New York, man." And Howie and Nelly, who I'd met later on, Brim Fuentes was a really massive influence. I've seen him in Hip Hop Arena before. And he's this kid that jumps into the tracks and runs across the train tracks and jumps out again. But they wanted to make this documentary about graffiti, but he wanted to see Birmingham and he wanted to know where the riots were happening. He wanted to go to Liverpool and... So the director didn't have a choice. He was like, "I ain't going to make this movie, man. I want to go up north." And
I want to see the Mersey, yo.
Yeah, I want to see the Mersey. So he came to Wolverhampton. And I'm like, what do you mean? I want to
this
see
is
your
where
environment.
Walls are from.
I know it was really weird because the bombing documentary, which expanded because of Brim, and God bless him because I wouldn't be here without him. You know, and I'd obviously been into this book for about a year, Subway Art, and seen all this stuff, and was going to like Halfords to steal like the pissiest paint ever. You know, which took like 40 layers just to get the red to look red.
They didn't have the Krylons?
Oh, no Krylon, none of that stuff. It was like really bad Halfords paint that you paint your bike with. You know, so I'd be doing crazy shit like painting the wall white with emulsion, then doing it, letting it dry overnight.
So you could get actually a good print,
then painting the next day, and then it rained on the third day, so the white just drips all the emulsion over what your attempt was, a really bad piece of graffiti anyway. And it was crazy. His impact on my life was huge. And he said, why don't you get him out to New York? So me and the guy I was breakdancing with called Birdie, we got this Virgin ticket. I hadn't left the country. And they thought it'd be a great idea. And I'm in New York, in Manhattan, staying at the Chelsea Hotel. Wow. You know, hanging out of a window.
You know the Chelsea Hotel? Anybody raise their hand if you don't know the Chelsea Hotel. All right, a lot of bad shit went down there. Like,
yeah.
Like Sid stabbed Nancy there. Didi Ramone smoked crack in the basement and spoke to Johnny Thunder's dead
but
ghost.
But EOD there? EOD there, right? I think it was crazy. And it was just one of these places that I remember, you know, I've got a
Goldie stayed there.
I got this footage of me standing by a window like this, going, look, and the Chelsea Hotel going, mano banana, salada banana, mano banana, trying to act like Spanish, because obviously everyone speaking to me in Spanish because I look like Puerto Rican.
Yeah, I thought he was Puerto Rican. I was like, hey, mano. He's like,
yeah, I know, mano.
Goldie. I was like, all right.
What you mean, mano? From Wolverhampton, what are you talking about? So, you know, I had this thing, and they just took to me, and I always remember, like, and then going from Manhattan to the Bronx with Brim and the film crew. And the city just changed. And it was like this dream of the Big Apple just died all of a sudden. But in a good way. Yeah. It was like rebirth. And what was strange about it was that when Brim came to Wolverhampton and we had to break into my mother's flat because she got evicted. And we went into my bedroom and I had my first mural because I was always one of these people that was me being a Virgo. It's got to be the whole thing. If you're not going to attempt to do graffiti until you've got it right on paper, you get it absolutely right.
Did you block it out?
I blocked it out and made sure the colors were right. And I painted this American flag with a Statue of Liberty and B-boys on the wall in the bedroom. And it was the whole thing. Damn. And we broke in with a torch and they're filming this shit. And I'm like, yeah, man, I want to live the dream, man. And then I realized that when I get to Manhattan, that wasn't what the, you know, that Statue
That's
of Liberty.
That's not the dream, yeah.
That ain't the dream. Yeah. And I was walking with Brim after we finished filming across the Bronx, which was still, you could still smell cinders because the Bronx was on fire for that 2 years before that. And there were literally blocks that were, it was a little bit like this before they built this. You'd have one building and then you'd have like 10 blocks where it was just rubble.
Yeah.
And a few roads.
If my wife and I were watching the movie The Get Down, that thing on Netflix.
Yeah, I mean,
the only thing that was actually historically accurate was the fact that shit was fucked up.
Yeah, it was all fucked up. I mean, everything else was a little bit shady in the way they put it together.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, I never forget this. I remember we were on a handball court because I'd obviously had this book and it was about trains. And I hadn't seen people doing graffiti in handball courts, right?
Yeah, that was the big cement wall that changed
You know,
every
it's
week.
Like the community center was the handball court. So culturally, I'm taking all this in, man. And I'd seen these pieces, and I saw this Futura piece. And I smoked, you know, I remember trying to roll a spliff, and Brim's like, what do you mean you put a cigarette, put a Newport in the blunt? Are you crazy? Because it was like pure weed with like the cigar with the fat willy, and you know, you'd pull out the tobacco from the cigar, and you'd roll it. And he's like, go on, smoke it. It's a blunt. I'm like, all right, yeah, cool. Yeah, this is great. And I'm like, oh, this is too crazy. The world's going to end. But I remember standing looking at this graffiti piece, Futura, and I just felt the blood. I felt it coursing through me, man. I felt my vein. I felt alive in a way I'd never seen anything like this. And, you know, we'd gone back to Brim's house, and I ain't going to lie, man, seriously. He's like, yo, man, let's go. So we're going to go out of town. I'm like, you know, we're going to go see some blow. And I'm like, all right, what's blow? I'm like, go out. And we go to this tenement yard, we're going up these stairs, and there's like there's a guy with two Rottweilers, and there's some heavy guys in the basement. We go up another flight, and there's another set of guys, and then we go to this door, and it's like a steel door, and we bang the door, and we go in, and there's like a corridor with goons either side, And you go in there, and he's like big fat guy sitting there with a pair of scales. And I'm like, I just want this to be over really quickly. And then Brim does some transaction and some shit.
Well, how much did he buy? It sounds like you guys
are
like,
or some shit.
Oh, yeah, I thought it sounds like you guys are buying kilos.
No, it sounds like, to me, to me, might as well have been. Do you know what I mean? I'm like, shit. And it's, you know, we just get high. And we're just buzzing. And then we start, you know, I'm like, what does this shit do? And he's like, yo, man, you're going to be like a lawyer. you're gonna speak like a lawyer, think you know everything to deal with, and then you're gonna seal the deal, and then you're gonna collapse. All right, cool.
That's pretty, for all you kids who have not done that drug, that's pretty much what it is in a nutshell.
And you know, and that's it. And you know what? That's it. You know, guys, don't do drugs. It's gonna fuck you up.
You're gonna act like a lawyer.
You're gonna act like a super lawyer without the car and the Maserati.
I object, Your Honor.
Yeah, and that's it. So, you know what I mean? You know, you might just be able to afford a half a gram, but you're not going to get the hookers to go with it. So, you know, it's one of those kind of things. So this transaction was a pretty bad transaction. But of course, so believe me, the dollar exchange was good then.
Back then, yeah.
I got a lot of yayo for my pound, man, right? So it was a great experience. And then we did like this commercial in Fordham Road. Which was crazy.
Yeah, that's the Bronx. Yeah, the Fordham Road's like famous. That's where you got the good sneakers, though.
Well,
right?
Listen, man, I went there, and when Brim took me to a thrifty store in Fordham Road, and I walked in because you know, we're looking at breakdance videos, on Gladys Knight or Buffalo Girls. We're looking at videos. Back then, you would collate with a kid that could edit. What you'd do is you'd get a press play and record and the pause button.
Yeah.
On your TV, and anything that was to do with breakdance, you put it on. And you'd have a compilation, like a mixtape, of video clips.
Chronologically.
And you'd go, oh my God, look at these sneakers. Pause. It's a pair of Puma States, man. It is. We can get it. We travel around London trying to find these things. And then we go and I'd see my first like Ice Wash Goose, the original Goose Down Bomber. And I just got this shit. And what I did, they only had one pair left. And at that time, I was a size 10, right?
So you kept the wrong size.
No, this is the only one they had was a light pink, light pink Puma State, and it was a 9. And I was going to make that shit like bitches in heels, man. You know, you can wear your shit. It's like, just I see these women going like this in a club. And I was like, yeah, I'm a homeboy, man. I'm going to walk this shit off. You know, and I'm like, this shit's fucking blisters and all, but I walked it off.
Did you take the laces in, like, because I always say, don't choke your laces,
no,
right?
No, choke them, take them out, spread them out, you know, and just easy. Be B-boy. And that was it. And for me, that culture from a kid from Wolverhampton, the first time when it impacted me, and we, of course, went to Henry Chalfont's studio in Canal Street. And I remember walking in his studio, because obviously we're doing this documentary, and Henry Chalfont, for those of you that don't know, him and Martha Cooper put this book together. So imagine, the 2 years before this happens, you see this book called Subway Art.
Yeah.
And then 2 years later, you're in New York, you're in Canal Street at this studio of a sculptor who was taking all this shit down. He'd given up at a sabbatical ways photographing these. These kids would phone him up at his studio, which I found out later on, and say, yo, Henry, you know, he's coming in on the east side. And he would go out, he would get a tip left on his answering machine, and he would go and photograph on the different stations the trains. And he archived this over the years. And he had these big gnarly-ass books of just train after train after train. And a lot of them, historically now, have gone. They'll never exist. Yeah. And that's like burning the Mona Lisa or getting a Picasso and just throwing it in a river and losing it. I'm sure those guys lost a lot of work. But for something that was culturally probably the most important and significant, this was for me, when I look back on it, the first internet. Kids,
it was a communication tool.
Communication.
For sure.
We're sending signals, messages to Queens. Queens sending messages to Brooklyn. You know, these different pathways, these trains, these veins.
Yeah, they go through. They start in Brooklyn. They go through Manhattan. They cut over to Queens. They go back into Manhattan. Go up to Brooklyn. You know, and you'd put your own little mark on it. And by the time it got there, like, I mean, it was almost like smoke signals.
It was exactly that. And I think the importance of the first trip was we were breakdancing. And we went back down to Manhattan after this crazy. I was in the Bronx River. I met Bambada. You know, we're there in their community, and I'm finally in their Heath Town, which was my hometown then. Which kind of Brim saw the relevance. He was like, "I feel like I'm at home where you live." And I never thought this kind of a state would even be it would even exist, but they have projects in the UK. Yeah,
I found that really bugged out too. I was like, whoa, what's going on? All of a sudden, well, you're at Notting Hill and you turn to make a left, and all of a sudden it's not.
You're there.
It's not Hugh Grant, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know, it's crazy. So, we you know, I come back and it was so mind blowing. You know, I wanted to completely throw myself into this culture. And I wanted to be the bad, you know, baddest ass of graffiti and everything else. And I kind of went back and had a time there without everyone else, and you know, without, and just stayed with Vulcan and Brim and just stayed there. And he is
dropping names like he's in the Chinese phone book. These people he's talking about, Futura. I mean, these are the guys, you know, that started this whole thing.
And it was crazy because when I went back there, you know, my old thing was Painted Train. It was 116th Street in Lexington.
Yeah.
And I go to Vulcan's house. Vulcan takes. He goes, gets an old sofa. He pulls the sofa apart, takes the foam from the sofa, pours plaster of Paris over the foam letters in white. Then he paints them with zebra stripes, puts them in his massive shopping bags with loads of glue. We go with all his paint and we pull off the lid. We go down and down and down. We get into the layup because it's freezing cold in New York. Yeah. And they kept the train on a layup. It's like a inside a tunnel to keep the train warm.
Like off to the side of a tunnel, yeah.
So it's like a little skip that you could put the train so it keeps warm. It's going to keep first service. And I'm doing it. I'm painting this train in New York, and I've got a picture of this train. It's amazing. Yeah. It just says Gerald, and it's Love Heart. And then Vulcan sitting down with his foam, and it's like he's got these letters that he's sticking onto the train. And he's like, keep your feet there for like 3 minutes. And I'm like, okay. And we're sticking, it's actually sticking letters to the side of the train, man. And a lot of cats wasn't even doing that. It was about being creative. Yeah. But I remember it was this big hoo-ha. And this is a really, I don't think I've ever told this story. A year earlier that I'd gone there and finally got this apple that had been, not destroyed, but rebirthed, if you like. I'd met Nock 167.
Oh, okay.
And who did Style Wars? Okay. I've never seen the documentary.
Another amazing artist.
When he says Style Wars, the graffiti documentary, which is basically the Bible for us. You've got Wild Style and Style Wars. Style Wars, this piece that was done by Nock 167, was just the most mind-blowing piece. I mean, the guy was on angel dust. He was this little kid, and I met this kid, and then I met Case 2 comes along, and Case 2 was the guy in Style Wars that's like, you know, one leg, one arm, and he's a yo, 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 the Beastmaster, one arm Case. And I'm like, this guy's a legend. And we're doing this commercial, and I've got this cycling top. It's an Atler cycling top to break, right? Because cycling tops were the thing, right? So we change, and I put the top down. I turn around, and he's got it on. He's just got the top on. Like, he just vicked it. He just took it.
Your shit.
He just took my shit. I'm like, that's my top, man. Like, he's like, I don't know, sorry, man. You want the shit back? And I'm like, yeah, I kind of want it back. You know what I mean? But I remember putting it on, and it just smelled of him.
Yeah? In a good way?
Well, kind of funky, you know?
Yeah,
right?
I mean.
But it was like,
he's a funky
I'm
dude.
I'm like, geez, this guy's a dude. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I'm like, I'll never wash it ever again. But this is the story, though. This is the get back. Meeting your heroes and meeting these guys like this, they're in this seminal documentary. I saw him the year later. There's this big commotion, and he just came out like a gorilla in the mist. He came out of this darkness, man, and he was like, yo, man, you got any paint? And he was cracked out of his mind. He was like, he'd gone. And Vulcan and Per and Dero.
Oh, Dero.
Dero was there.
Dino, right?
Dero was having this beef with his other cat, so they get in the car and they have a fight because he'd been crossing him out for a year, which is his whole thing. And then the next thing is that this guy just turns up going, yo, man, I remember you. Oh. You that English dude, right?
Oh, really? Just hands off.
Yo, man, you got some money over there? What you got? So we gave him some pain. I gave him like $20 or some shit. He was like, he kind of destroyed me. It was like this feeling that it was just consumed. You know, that whole thing. Because people forget that, you know, I was always about, yeah, you know, you know, why do we paint about something good? New York was too far gone.
Yeah.
It's about get your name up. Just for identity, there was nothing else that was to it, you know.
The one thing I kind of with you talking about that story, and it happens to us because we're at a certain age where when we look back on our people that we knew back then, half of them are fucking gone because of this thing. And you kind of see how New York kind of goes when all these good people go, because Manhattan now it's pretty much just rich folk, man.
Yeah, I just think that I think that Pandora's box of that culture.
Sorry.
I think the Pandora's box of the culture was so colossal, the power that came out of that stuff. Well, the whole good and the bad comes out.
I mean, you think about, like, you know, Gerb, Futura, Stash, all those dudes, but Basquiat, I mean, Keith Haring, all these dudes were hanging with all these.
They're all part of the same thing, and it was like, I guess,
but there were a lot of
Banksy now. It was like they had lots of Banksy. That's what I'm saying.
You mean that dude from Massive Attack?
But you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know. Is it Robin? Is it Robin? What are we saying?
Say that shit out loud.
Rodriguez. It's Rodriguez. You know? Really? I revealed what? Get out of here. Fuck out of here, man.
I am Banksy.
No,
I am Spartacus.
Yeah, no, I'm Spartacus. I'm Spartacus. I'm Spartacus. I'm Spartacus.
I'm Spartacus.
There you go.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Right, so we had this whole thing, and it was like then you had all these guys that were really, that paid homage to those writers because they knew where the energy came from, and I think Fat Five Freddy knew that.
Yeah, yeah.
All these guys knew that.
Well, Freddy hung with Basquiat. He hung with everybody.
He hung with everyone. I just think that time was the most exciting time where the culture wasn't, he wasn't scared to, you see now, we'll get paid to go and play some expensive party. You get paid. It's very clinical. Then you could go and hang at Studio 54. These guys want to go and come to the Bronx and party with these guys because it was about that thing. It was about, we don't care. We want to be punk about this.
Yeah, and also, that was Delancey Car Service at Studio 54. Any of these clubs back in the day, be like, yo, let's go up to the Bronx. How are we going to get there? Delancey.
Let's go to the Bronx. Yeah. Because it was about this thing about, imagine the guys from the West End go, yo, let's just go to Hackney, man. Let's just go hang out with his homeboys and listen to some grime, yeah? Well, now that's
Brian, get your coat. We're going to Hackney.
We're gonna listen to Skeps and Stormzy back to back in his club in his house.
Chuck your chain.
Yeah. You know, that wouldn't happen, but it happened then because it wasn't surrounded by the social media bullshit. It was real cats who could actually understand about being down. It wasn't about just being rich. It was a class thing for those guys, that people that made it really knew their roots. Mm-hmm. And Blondie was a big champion of that. Yeah, Debbie Harry was a massive champion of that.
She's mad cool.
You know, and it was crazy. But I think, you know, coming back and fast forward, the impact, you know, I'd like to take kids from, you know, I kind of see these kids now and it's like, yeah, man, it was really bad. We're living in a really bad time. You got a flat, man. I know, I get it. You know what I mean? Like, have you been to like San Paolo? Have you seen this shit? Have you been to the Bronx and seen when it's on fire? And you know, now shit's happening now, which reminds me of some bad shit that's going on. Yeah. I don't want to mention it, but it's, you know, it's certain things shouldn't happen in this day and age. But I feel quite blessed of seeing that because it's very insightful. I came back to this country, just changed, you know, and you give me, you know, 15 kids who don't know who they are, I take them to India. Go practice some yoga any day in a week. I think you take someone out of this environment and you see the world, because when you see the world through a phone, you don't see the world. You don't have any real quantum about real life. Mm. And that's the problem that we have. The trick, the velvet claw, I call it, of technology.
The what?
The velvet claw. You know, it's very smooth, but it's a claw, man. It's like it's going to destroy you in the end because,
that's great.
You know, technology is about joyriding that bullshit and joyriding it. I've never wanted to engineer because I know my dyslexia and synesthesia would stop me. But you give me three engineers, I'm going to tell you what the fuck to do. You know why? Because I learned from graffiti. The idea, the outline, two-dimensional to three-dimensional to give me four-dimensional Escher, to give me the color so I can see and I can arrange the picture. And I can weave those letters in and out, and that's the picture right there. When you've got that outline, this is done, baby. It's done. Graffiti writers working in the middle of the night where brown looks like red, and you don't have that many colors, you've got to make it work. You know, you run into a sweet shop and you go, and the owner's not there. What do we steal? What do we steal? He's gone, fuck it. You take nothing. Right? So these kids now are going, oh my fucking selfie, I'll take a fucking picture, this, that, fuck. What do you do? What do you do? I don't know what we do. And you know, it's like if you earn it in that kind of the university of the street, I call it, because the arts was the effeminate.
Yeah.
The arts, the graffiti, the braiders, and the culture. The man, the male, was the aggression, the shooting, the game, all of that. And it's always been on a parallax.
Yeah.
It's the choices we make coming up through that game. Because when those guys started selling those tapes and started getting successful, you know, one of my oldest friends from Orlando who taught me to make gold teeth and brills, you know, was, you know, they came from Suriname, Eddie's Gold, in the Coliseum. You know, he made Jay-Z's, you know, first gold tooth when he's 17. He made Just Ice. All those front covers
Just
that we saw.
Just Ice.
That record sleeve was like, my God, I want that one. Yeah. You know, well, that 17, you know, and it was like that. So the culture of all of that stuff, it wasn't like I'm trying to show off. It was like I was in Miami where everyone had gold teeth.
Well, Miami is not like where the Kardashians hang out back in the day. It wasn't like that in like the last 10 years. But
well, it was
Miami
booty clubs.
Was hard.
It was booty clubs, and you couldn't go on the first few from Collins. You couldn't go on the beach because that was like some Scarface shit. You couldn't go on those three floors.
But the one thing I always loved was two things, actually. The yayo, you could eat on it. So anytime you go to like some kind of booty club, as he called it, they'd serve food because you could eat, right? It was that good. It was like beige.
This is really bad saying that you could eat on really good coke. Sorry, that's a really bad thing. But you could, instead of being like, like now, you know, it's like speed driven.
These are good olives, man. You know, no, thank you. I don't want to dance. I want some more olives, you know.
But it was, I think that part of the culture, and let's just round it off, but that particular chapter of my life has resonated. I think even with a new album, you know, Castaway is basically New York, Bronx bound, Miami Nice, which is the name of a strip club, by the way, not like the Nice is in the evening. You know, and it was like, you know, like ghetto sound. And it was also being in the Grand and listening to Kiss being played, Prince, on WBLS. The first time I ever heard Kiss was on that record. So it reminded me.
The world's best looking sound. That was the thing,
right? You know what I mean? And I think, you know, hearing Prince do that record, it was like it stayed with me. You know, New York, the impact of that record, Kiss. I just, you know, just want to. And also, for me, Tyler Daly comes from Manchester. He's a sweet boy. He's got a sweet boy voice. And I mean, to the point where there's a track on the album called This Is Not a Love Song. And my friend went, why would you get two lesbians to sing the song? I'm like, they're both females. One's male and one's a female.
But he's
and
got
like,
a sweet boy voice.
They couldn't make the difference between if Tyler was the girl or the guy because he's got such a sweet boy voice. But in soul music, you've always had that kind of...
Yo, that's old school calling somebody having a sweet
school,
boy voice.
Where the band would do the slide out and the main guy was like, yo, sweet honey. Gotta keep me going.
The guys in the back are like,
yeah, you know, and the guy's like, yeah, keep it going, honey. Yeah, you sing at the back. You're not going to be the front singer. So I think in terms of this story is really in that album, but without the words. We talk enough, me. Yeah.
Well, the thing is, when we first spoke about the record, because I was literally, I played the song on my radio show. I called you up, and you called me back. I text him. He calls because, you know, Goldie don't want to text. He's like Machete. Goldie don't text. Machete don't text. Goldie call you up and you're like, yo, I'm on the air. I got. Okay. No. My man's on the phone. But yeah, really, that was the thing. When I first heard it, all I heard was the stories you were telling me about New York, and it made me really think about all the things that I loved about the city. And it's really transcendental to be able to do that with music. I mean, it's one of those things where now we're almost conditioned to expect the unexpected, but this was unexpected to the mm-hmm. fact that it was so vivid. You know, like all these influences that you were just talking about mm-hmm. were brought to bear on this record. And that's one of the things I loved about this new record. And you were telling me something really cool, which I want to mention. You were like, you know, I this is the best shit I've ever done. And you know what? I agreed with you then, and I only heard one song. And I've been listening to it, and I'm kind of like, you're bringing all this knowledge to the table.
But I also think I get some of my friends that I keep really close, and you keep them, and they're really big critics as well.
Oh, yeah, they got to be.
And they'll be like, oh, he's just gassing again, man. You know what I mean? Like, geez, just gassing. But I'm like, no, seriously. And my friend will come and go, yo, man, kind of right, you know, I've got a little tear in my eye, you know. It's like, you know, hardened people that are like hardened guys on roads that I know. But I think that's the thing. If your very fabric and DNA is made up of certain things, and I spoke about the Pandora's box, I became a parody of myself, man. I'm like, Strictly Come Dancing and this and that. I'm like, get to pay for the divorce case. You know, because you do that. You know, you grow up, you do this. You know, I married a stripper. You know what I mean? I married someone that was not going to love me in the way that my mom was the same. I married my mother in that respect because that's what the Hoffman process was about. And for all of you that don't know what the Hoffman process is, just go and do that. I tried rehab twice. It failed. I think that the whole process of cynicism of modern kids that are brought up in this synthetic world, for me, that old shit ain't going to work for me. The AA is not going to work for me because I've grown up in a different culture. So for me, to be able to be visceral with the record, there's something I've always quoted other people on lots of other things, and we don't know where that line is gray and we cross over. But the one thing I woke up at like 3 in the other night and just went, shit, that's it. A truthful idea lasts in the honesty of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I feel that that's kind of like, I feel the clarity that I have is I'm going to make a record like this. This is what it's going to be. And the process that I use is a type of, is what I call the seancic method. The seancic method. You look at a seance, it's like raising bad deity. This is kind of seancic, where it's like I pull a musician, a great engineer, some great people, keep the water clear.
Yeah.
Because it's the water and the mud which messes up the artist. Not that he'd been able to do it. Doing it's not a problem.
Yeah, she's like, what the fuck are you talking about?
I did that. I became a parody of myself. I did all these things. You know, I have this great reminder here, you know, of the greatest, the most beautiful accidents I've ever had.
Pull out, man.
Oh, yeah. I'm like, I've got this really great idea.
I didn't think this dude over here was like,
yeah, you know,
that's not the reaction dude should have, man.
I always think that it's that beautiful accident. You know, I did one reality show too many. I was hemorrhaging. I was paying for a divorce. You know, this is a kid that's never had all this stuff. I never had the tools for being a father or a parent. So I'm thrown into this mad world. I've just blown the fuck up, and I'm doing like a private party for Catherine Zeta-Jones and Michael Douglas, and you know, some mad security and this and that. And it's like, you know, I'm sitting in Chateau Marmont 1010 where Belushi OD'd with fucking Val Kilmer going, "Speak to Ted Turner." Oh, hey, it's Goldie. Ted, is that Goldie? And it's like Ted Turner's on the phone. Yeah. And I'm like,
that's the guy who started CNN.
What the fuck? And I'm like,
for real,
what is this?
Yo, he's trying to start a fight with a friend of mine in the bathroom.
And it's just crazy. He's a weird guy. And I'm speaking, and there's all these candles that, and like Val Kilmer's going, it's me, Val Kilmer, and Josh Evans, who's still my best, one of my best friends, Robert Evans' son. He's like Mr. Hollywood.
Yeah, the kid stays in the picture.
It's a great book. It's a great book, and they're making a play now. It's going to open in New York. Oh. They did it here. One of my other friends, Clint Dyer, is playing one. They've got 12 versions of Robert Evans.
Okay, cool.
And they've got one black version of him. I guess that's the Coke version. I'm not sure which version that is. And he was just sitting there in his room full of candles, and he's like, yo, man, timeless is amazing. And I'm like, yeah, where's the Coke? So it's kind of like this mad experience. And I think all of that's in the album, but the discipline, you know, the mirrored river, the river mirrored, you know, what you see in the water and what comes out of the water, and just being in a different environment. I thought to myself, I wasn't going to do anything. We built this house in Thailand, and why I call it the beautiful accidents, because I was in a hospital. I was supposed to do this gig in Thailand, in Asia, He got cancelled. I've been in hospital for like 13 weeks. And
so you're in for that.
Yeah.
Like we're not getting out.
We finally rebook this gig. I go to Shanghai and we have this big dinner. And my wife walks in, my future, my wife now, she's, this woman walks in. First, my friend walks in. You know, she walks in and my boy's on the phone. I'm like, what, you can't make it? He's like, no, I'm stuck in Bangkok. Mm. I'm like, I thought you were gonna make this big dinner, man. It's our birthday in like a week. We share the same birthday. And then this girl walks in and it's in this hotel called, it's called New Heights. And it's like old colonial marble floors. Yeah. And this girl walks in with a pair of jeans and like heels. And I can hear this girl's heels on the floor, right? I'm like, hold on, hold on, man. This chick just walked in. He went, yeah, she's with me. And he jumps out behind his chick. And I'm like, I'm like, so what's the deal with this chick then? And I'm like, so we start talking at dinner. And anyway, we start dating. We have a 2-week kind of mad dating in Japan. I'm not going to lie to you. It's the first time I've ever courted and not fucked, straight up. Mm-hmm. We spent 2 weeks on a bullet train. And how it started was that we watched a great film called Ashes to Snow, and Fish is narrating it.
Oh, yeah.
Fishburne's narrating it. And it's by James Colbert, the lung diver.
Yeah.
Who's a famous artist in New York. And it starts with his kid going backwards on a boat through elephants. And we're like, it's three sections. It's like these Buddhists, these swirling dervishes and Indians. We're living with elephants.
Yeah.
And then these mad eagles, and no, this old people that live with leopards. Yeah. And you can't tell the difference between an old man and an old woman.
That was trippy. Yeah, it was like this. Yeah.
Trippy-ish. And it's all shot in real film. Mm-hmm. And we're just sitting there crying our eyes up at the end of this film going, we really can't fuck after this. So we just don't make out. And we just caught for 2 weeks. And then that's the whole thing. I wrote letters for a whole year. Yeah. And then decided that's it. We went there for 9 years running, and they decide, let's go and build a house there.
Now, do you think because of your honesty with yourself now that this music can happen? Because I kind of came to a point too where, you know, where it was like, what am I really given anymore? And then you kind of go away and you kind of get a sense of truth in a lot of ways. Because, I mean, I know you, and we're probably our own worst enemies in a lot of ways. Huh. You know what I'm saying?
The enemy.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying? And once you kind of are brutally honest with yourself, which I know we both do on very many occasions, you almost come out the other end with almost a, let's say, hyper-vigilant sense of critical thought.
We become like all of our enemies, the criticizers. We know when someone's watching us, when you're buzzing or whatever else. And it really, I think it's the cracks in the china we saw. And I kind of realized that and became a parody. And I thought, am I going to reinvent? And I think Saturn's Return was that difficult second album. Yeah. But I had to make Mother, because the voice in my head was saying, Mother. I was lamenting for Mother. Mm-hmm. I had to make this 60-minute piece. I had to. I had no choice in the matter. And it was like, I can't communicate with my mother, but I have to make this hour-long piece for some reason.
Well, I mean, it was cathartic, and it was also, you know, I mean, you probably learned more about yourself than you did your mother, right?
Well, I think it was, I learned more about myself, but also I remember when John Niven, who was the marketing director for London Records, you know, he made Kill Your Friends. Yeah. That book's based on me. You know, the guy DJ Rage, who's got this.
Oh, you're DJ Rage?
I'm DJ Rage. Of course,
shit, that's right.
Think about it. He says that the chapter is DJ Rage hasn't let the record company listen to the record for a year. We finally get to the studio. His eyes are beady. He holds his hands out over the desk. He presses play, and nothing happens for like 15 minutes. It's just gas and air. And I look at Schroeder, which was Pete Tong. The names had to be changed.
Yeah.
And I know his career is well and truly over. So, you know, it was venomous, but it was true. Yeah. It was like, but Mother as a piece is still a tragic opera, and will be made into a tragic opera in the coming years. But I knew that album had to be made. But I think in terms of best work, you know, going to Thailand and being no one, just walking around and people just say, you know, they call me Phan Tong in my village, which just means Mr. Gold. And that's it. You know.
Yeah, he's a Bond villain. You went from being in a Bond movie not to be the fucking
guy. To being like this guy who lives in the village. And he's, they say, yeah, he Phan Tong, he close. And I'm like, I realized that, because what happened was I shipped everything. I wasn't coming back here. And I've got a really vast collection of shit, man. Like clothes, like Stussy, like Mad Hill figure. And I just gave it all away, man. Yeah. I just had enough.
Where was I, man?
But I gave it to all these Burmese camps.
Oh, really?
Right, that around the village that build all these villas for these people. So I'm looking up and he's going, "Yo, Phan Dong!" And he's wearing like a Cool Hill figure top. You know what I mean? And, this guy's wearing like a Stussy rayon with orchids. And he's just plastering his paint fucking all over his shit. I'm like, yeah, man. Wear it like
that would be That would be the best... like catalog for Stussy
or Supreme.
Best.
I always said this would be the best.
Like spackling some shit in Thailand, like what?
Yeah, you know? Yeah, it would be amazing. And I think it taught me something because we hold on to shit because of a past and what it done to us. Mm-hmm. You know, and we always live in that kind of past. And I think it taught me a lot about myself because it was all in storage for 18 months.
And if so, you don't need it, you don't.
I open this case. I'm like, what the fuck did I even ship this for? This cost me money, man. They weighed this shit and they shipped it. So
82 t-shirts or some shit,
man,
right?
No, yeah. there were over 1,000 pieces. I mean, in terms of just t-shirt, there was like crazy shit.
But the thing is, we come from modest beginnings. So if anybody gives us shit, we keep it because you never know. You never know if you're gonna need that t-shirt, or you're gonna need that baseball hat, or those pair of kicks you get for free.
My wife was crazy. She was like, you better lose that shit, man.
Yeah, I know.
So she kind of like slowly start kind of like getting rid of shit.
My wife calls it editing. She goes, you need to edit this. And I call it unfucking. So I can't say it. I'm like, I can't unfuck that. That's my life. She goes, edit that shit.
Or no fucky.
No fucky, yeah.
So I did that. And we were very lucky because my wife knew these really, really great Chinese Thai people that we've done a lot of work. She did a lot of work for and earned them a lot of money. And they said, yeah, we'll get the land because he's 51% to them and 49% to us. But the house is with us. It's our land. We built it from scratch. We built it around a beautiful 200-year-old tree.
Oh, man.
And it's the tree house. And
you got things
happening? Oh, yeah. I built a tree. It's like right in the
canopy. Return of the Jedi
It's right up in the mountains. It's in a canopy of the jungle. And it overlooks the sea to the right. And it's the tree house. And there's a recording studio cut into the hillside. And it's just... an amazing, the karma of this place. Because remember that I come from all this stuff and I ended up getting my first record deal. I'd always been in tenement yards, Dorney, my mentor's been evacuated from. It's in Dorney Tower. I've gone from that to New York, to Miami, to Dorney Tower, to getting a record deal and get my first house.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know, I had to let go of that house because it was a really bad divorce in that house. But letting go was the best thing because of the Hoffman. Mm-hmm. We end up in Thailand with this new thing for the family. And we have Coco, Sakuko, who's a wonderful 6-year-old. And she goes to school with no shoes on. And she does a math lesson in the forest, awesome. Counting trees. That's all I want, man. That's all I really want.
You came up in like this urban decay kind of vibe. We're about the same age, right? I came up in the same thing. I got a place out in Somerset. I fucking love it. My wife wants to get back to the city as soon as possible. But for me, I think in a lot of ways you find the stuff that you thought was so foreign more comforting than the stuff you grew up in because it shows that you've kind of changed the way you think a little bit about stuff that you came up. Because, I mean, everybody talks to me about New York City. Like, Huey, tell us about New York City. It's like, I can't. It's too personal.
It's personal.
You know?
Well, you said Muhammad Ali, you know, a great quote, Muhammad Ali said that, you know, if you get to 30 and you know everything, if you get to 50 and you're saying the same shit you were saying when you're 30, you haven't learned anything.
Oh, damn.
You know, and I think for men, Saturn's return, what it says is from 28 to 32, that period is what some people call midlife crisis. I call it, it's just Saturn's return. It's an actual real thing where all the planets line up to the same line as when you were born. And that's why we stop and we question everything.
Yeah.
It's a real thing. And women, it happens a lot earlier because they're, you know, not as stupid as us.
Yeah, they're not bothered.
And, you know, and we just hang on to shit. But that period of doing that, you know, we built a house 5 years ago. We've been living in it for like, three years. And we built it 5 years ago. And it's just, it was literally serendipity. And I have to quote David on this. David Bowie told me, I always remember him reaching out. He wanted to do a track. And I'd had a 5-day bender. I woke up and there's a record mailer and I see the words. And I write in this really in graph font, you know?
Yeah.
I write in capital letters. I don't write in nothing else. There's no lowercase to me. Yeah. And it's a beautiful script. I've took him a long time to master it, but it's a great script.
Yeah.
And one of the lines in it says, tomorrow for you to know that sorrow hides in sculpture. And I faxed it to David's office through Alan Edwards, his manager, who's still his manager now. God rest him. And he gets the facts, and we hang out. We go and have dinner, and then we've got the date arranged, and we're going back to a studio in which he already recorded Space Oddity 20 years before.
Which one was it?
The studio. It was Space Oddity. It was St. Anne's Court.
Oh yeah, man.
And there was a picture of him in a trilby, which I went to after the deal was made with Timeless doing that second album. You know, I was a man of the moment. So, you know, I was in town a lot. I was at all the bars we used to meet at, and those parties.
Oh, Goldie's here, thank
and
God.
And I saw Mel Gaynor, and Mel Gaynor's from Simple Minds. I got this studio, I want to sell it. Yeah, yeah. So we go to Mel Gaynor's studio in St. Anne's Court in Soho, and I seal the deal. We buy the studio, and Rob Playford gets it for Moving Shadow. He moves from Stevenage, where he's done Timeless with me, to Uptown to do this second album. And I pass Bowie's image every day, thinking, I wonder if... Nah, it's never going to happen. And then lo and behold, there's a phone call saying the baby wants to meet you. We love Timeless. So he comes down, he walks in the studio, we're about to record, and he looks at the words, and he looks at it, and he says the line. And he goes, where'd you get that line from? It's a great line. Oh, I don't know. He went, you just got it out there, right? I went, yeah. He went, did you know that Michelangelo said that if you blow the dust off the marble, the sculpture already exists inside? And it was just like, yes, air punch. It was like that Karate Kid moment.
Yeah, well, see, all the greats like that dude, I mean, I met him a couple of times. We used to hang out a lot when he came to New York. They never took credit for any of this shit. Like, if you talked to, like, David Bowie would never say, yeah, I wrote that.
Yeah.
You know, he was just like... He literally called it lightning in a bottle. Keith Richards calls it lightning in a bottle. Like, they're not responsible for any of this stuff. And that's when you get on that rhythm, that frequency where it's just vibrating right, you know?
And it's that in that respect, I haven't wrote any of this motherfucker, this album. Yeah. This album's come because it's clear, the conduit. Mm-hmm. It really is. It gets to a point where, you know, I know rich people, and they've got rich. He's got the watch, the car, but I know wealthy. But I know... But I know wealthy people that would pass me.
I'm just putting
but I know,
saying,
yeah. Yeah, but I know wealthy people that would pass you in the street and you wouldn't know. Because their wealth is outside of the gravity of the bullshit.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And I think that's what I kind of realized. I'm Goldie. I used to wear all this. I used to be caked with everything.
I used to ask you to borrow shit for gigs.
You know, like, I mean, on everything.
I said I couldn't bring all my shit over. I can't borrow that chain for that gig.
I still have it, but I don't wear it. I wear my Goyas and my Goya for my daughter, and that's it. And I became that, and that's it.
When you, I know that you're a big proponent of yoga, right? And the Yo Gangsters, which I think is great.
Yo Gangsters.
No, but this is important shit because. I guess within the last 20 years, when we first started hanging out to where we've hung out now, we've both had a lot of issues to get to where we are. But I think we're both at a really cool place. Did yoga facilitate you having that real clear vision of what this record was going to be like? Because it's almost as if they're kind of, we were talking about, I guess, self-knowledge. Yoga's all about that. You have to learn about your body. You have to learn about your spirit. You have to try to get the two to actually hang out, which is tough.
Pretty difficult.
Yeah.
I think the thing that I'd realized when I did the Hoffman, going back 12 years, that was the one that really emptied the box and took the box apart, and I had to find out where the box was designed. Because mm-hmm. I think AA is about taking things out of a box, but you still have a box.
Yeah.
And you still got to put shit in the box. Yeah, so
exactly. Who built that box?
Yeah, who built the box?
Why is it so damn uncomfortable?
Yeah, why is the box? And what does it look like when you flat pack it and you look at it and the design? And that really was the main spark. And then it was about, you know, Michael Kopperman from like Stussy and Gimme Five.
He's a big yoga head, right?
Well, Michael got me into Bikram. Michael's like, I'm like, why is this motherfucker so chilled? I'm like, I want to smack this guy. You know what I mean? I just want to smack him around the chops. He's like, yeah, man, this is Bikram, baby. I'm like, well, what do you mean Bikram, baby? He's like, yeah,
yo. It's Bikram, baby.
So he said, come, and I'd gone with him.
So Bikram is the hot stuff, right?
Bikram was invented by Bikram Chowdhury. He came from India. It's based on Hatha. There's also Vinyasa, which is the god of yoga. You know, Stuart Gilchrist is God. He is God.
Well, I don't know much about yoga, well, but
people out there will know.
Yeah.
You know, because Bikram kind of put it into a tin, and it was kind of, I get it. But the great thing about Bikram, as much as he's had a lot of personal mat stuff go on, the one good thing about it, because he is a bit crazy. He's like,
most gurus
get like this because they come to the West, but they're still kind of, still Indian gurus. And they kind of have to felicitate, you know, he goes to LA and he's teaching Brooke Shields and Quincy Jones. It's going to affect him a little bit, right? So I kind of get that. You know, Quincy
Jones. I'm just trying to imagine some Indian guru dude, Brooke Shields, and Quincy Jones
in a
room.
Well, Abdul-Jabbar was one of his pupils. Well,
he hung out with Bruce Lee.
With Bruce Lee. So
it was all of that. But then you get all these scantily clad girls running around. And
that's what got you into it, right?
You know. No, but at first it's all about, then you think about that. You think, nah. But I realized once I kind of sort through the bullshit, and also the way that people would throw themselves at Bikram. But he was all into the fame, so he's kind of like,
he was kind of down
calling
that,
me up and down, and all he's listening. He's like, oh, Goldie, you know, like this Squatch, I have 250,000 mini Rolls Royce. I'm like, But you're still wearing flame shorts. I get it. But the practice for people in the West, I do like the way it's 42 degrees. You're in a room with a mirror looking at what you think is you. And then it becomes a very ugly image of you, because as soon as that starts to fall apart, and the ego gets beat the fuck out, and you start to see the ugly self, and you start to see the real, and finally through that you start to see the child you were. I think.
Yeah.
And I like the idea of that, because I've been 7 years practicing, and I only practiced once this week, which I practice like 4 or 5 times a week. So I'm gagging right now. I'm like, where's the gear? You know, because within Bikram. And one of the analogies, one of the best analogies I've said to people, you may knock it as much as you like. One, it should be taught in prison systems. Mm. Two, it should be in the school system. And, you know, I had the Vatican saying, yeah, it's demonic and all this shit. I'm like, let me just Google molesters in the church. Let me just Google molesters in yoga. There's a few little kind of slap on the ass things with Bikram Gazi.
He's calling you up at the flaming shorts. He's
kind
of molesting you.
Yeah, you know what I mean? He's like, whatever, you know. So I'm like, come on, man. And I think you can't fuck with some of this 5,000 years old that come out of India, that these people are fucking levitating, man. Mm-hmm. And I look at that thing, and it's kind of got me into other themes of yoga too, you know, going back to the source, vinyasa, which is about opening, you know, and pulling and inversions. But the thing about it is, once the analogy I say to people is, if I'm in a 90-minute class and I take away 44 minutes from the end and I take away 44 minutes from the start, for that 1 minute, how I feel in the middle of that class, what would I pay for that shit?
Yeah.
Because I'd pay £100 a gram for that shit.
Yeah.
Because it's that kind of powerful. Because, listen, believe me, if I don't know if any of you tried coke out there, but it did nothing when you did a line when you began. You were like, what the fuck was that supposed to do? You mean, what the fuck was that? It's only long, when you start to use cocaine over a period of time, you actually think, I'm a connoisseur.
Are you comparing yoga to cocaine
now? No, but I'm saying I am in a parallax, yes. Because it's all about endorphins.
Yeah.
It's all about you're searching for something. It's like people in New Orleans that are obese, that are searching for something in the food. There's nothing in the food.
We did come for a circle, because so you're talking about the first time you were buying coke with your boy in New York.
Yeah.
You had to go through all that bullshit.
All that bullshit.
To get it.
To get it.
Talking about the first half of the Bikram session to get to that.
To get to that point. It's exactly that.
That's awesome, right? Dude. Yeah.
And it's exactly that.
That's awesome.
But you see, once you realize, you'll only get that high by practicing.
Mm-hmm.
You can keep doing coke. You're not going to get any higher. You're going to fucking die. You know, yoga hasn't killed anyone.
Yeah.
Maybe one or two, maybe. But
that dude who kept his hand in the air for like 30 years.
I don't know,
right?
Something like
that. You hear about that dude?
Yeah.
You got to, he's just standing like this. Like, imagine like the first couple months, his wife's like, come on, get the fuck out of here.
Yeah.
He's like, nah, despite you, I will hold this up. And then a year goes by, she's like, fuck it, do it.
So for me, within that, what it did more than anything, it took away the neediness. Because I couldn't sleep in a house with fucking coke in that motherfucker. I'd rip that shit to pieces.
Wow.
Like looking for a lost key that ain't going to open any lock, man. And I mean that, you know. And it's like, you know, my friends are like, yo, G, what's up, man? I'm like, silly old you. I'd say, well, cool. Hey, you want that? You go ahead and knock yourself out.
Yeah.
I'm all right with that. Because I can't, I mean, I came from the airport with Kiev and another festival back to back. I'm going straight from the airport, straight into that motherfucker, case and all.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Because I get that skin. I'm like, I've got to get out of this skin. And I think going back to the point, it just keeps my water clear. I can think of every concept possible.
That's a great analogy, man. Because I guess it gets to the point where at first we don't care where we're swimming, right? Just the fact that we're in the fucking pool. All right, and then we're in the pool for 20 years.
Pool of chlamydia.
Yeah. Maybe pools may be a bad analogy.
Chlamydia might be an even worse one.
Yeah, no, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's really bad. That's really bad.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of ego, you know, men's egos swimming around like sharks, right?
But I think as time goes by, and we're talking about finding a beautiful place in the world, Thailand, right? Finding a beautiful place in yourself, keeping that water clean, You know, I think that's kind of what we can only strive for, being guys doing what we're doing, coming out the other side. Because a lot of cats that didn't come out that
tunnel. Didn't come out that side, man. They didn't come out the tunnel. And you know what? That CBD oil's really kicking in right now.
Yeah, you good with that?
I'm good with that.
Have you been messing with CBD for a while?
Yeah. It was a guy called Crust. I'd heard about it, and Crust got me into it. Yeah. I think, you know, taking that extract from hemp is for anyone out there, man, you know, ailments, you know, joints,
great
clarity.
Stuff.
It's good stuff. And
I'm going to do a pod on that. I've been talking to a bunch of people, talking to Kay, his girl Sophia, all them.
Oh, it's a beautiful thing. And I think, you know, look, there is no answer. There is no magic wand, man. You know, and I came out, I was in some meeting and gradually came out there and I have this like American conspiracy and I have a cigarette. This guy goes, oh, but you do yoga, man. You're smoking a cigarette. I'm in a fucking Dalai Lama.
Yo, you know what I mean? That would be great though if you were. The next one. Yo, think about what a PR fucking gain that is for all the Buddhists, man. They'd be like, yo, we did love the old Dalai Lama, but ladies and gentlemen, the new Dalai Lama.
Yeah, we found him. And we didn't have to go to Wolverhampton to find him. You know. But I think the beauty of all of these things is that I really mean it, guys. I really mean it, man. We're all the same here. And I say to people, man, it's 8 points of fucking blood, man. You piss and shit. The only thing that makes us different than the fucking animal kingdom is a fucking door and some really good bog paper, man. Because the minute we got up on our, fucking hinds and learned to walk, you know, we just started cunning beasts, aren't we? You know, and I really think that I think for me within the music, and I've been doing this shit for 25 years, and it's something you're going to register with this. There's a dutifulness with electronic artists, I think. I've come out of synthetic. I've learned to talk over a guy's shoulder when a program was in black and white going vertically. Now I speak over a shoulder of that going horizontally in color, and it's a lot easier to do. But I can take it further than that and work with instrumentation and sing what the fuck I want you to do. And this is the point. Some musicians spend their whole fucking lives learning to play guitar, a flute, and drums. And you're an electronic artist, and you get paid fucking probably 100 times more to push buttons, and you can't put some soul into that shit. So for me, don't get me wrong, there is some soulful electronic music, but I think there's a lot of cop out too. There's a lot of fudge out there, man. You know what I mean? And they know because it's the industry. It's like, fuck that. But you wouldn't feed it to your fucking kids, would you? Could you imagine a rock band going out and going, let's play really fucked up shit here? And he goes, I ain't going to play it to my kids. Yeah, wait, what's your album like, Dad? I would listen. Oh, I don't listen to that. It's shite. Yeah. You wouldn't do that. So if you can do that from a band point of view, you can do it electronically. Why would you do that, you know, any other time? It's music. All you're doing is saying, well, our music is not as important because it's electronic, but it pays 10 times more.
Yeah.
I've never got that. And because I don't engineer, I don't give a fuck about that machinery.
Yeah.
Because it's about
It's a
means to an end. And you have to apply. And it's this graffiti thing again. What is art? What is graffiti? What is all of that? It's the application of a medium to a surface. Whether I'm spitting on a mic, whether I'm putting a pen to ink, whether I'm fucking putting a towel on your arm, whether I'm, you know, putting an acetate to a reggae dub plate, whether I'm putting my fingers onto these strings. It's the application of medium to a surface. So I'm really about that.
Well, the fact that you can succinctly put that shit together is why you are Goldie and we are everybody else. And I think that's awesome. And like I was watching the Yo Gangster thing, right? And these young people are doing these holds, right? When they're doing stuff, it reminds me of the old breakdancing kids, right?
The physicality of holding posture. I realized, you know, I was very early on, because of the breakdancing early on in my life, I got standing head to knee really easily. And I was like, look at me, the big fucking high I am. And I was like, standing head to knee, but flex, yeah, great. And then I realized, it ain't about that. You know the hardest posture for me is? I'll show you.
Yes, y'all.
That's it.
Really, just
2 minutes. That's the hardest posture. Because I can fucking wipe the sweat.
Yeah.
I gotta fucking do this. I twist this. Dead man's pose.
Yeah. Dead man's pose, yeah.
It's the hardest pose because That's where the discipline
comes in. Dead man's pose.
I mean, when I was in boot camp in the Marines, it was in South Carolina. It was springtime. They had sand fleas all over the place, and all they wanted you to be able to do was stand still. And if you moved, that was the discipline. If you moved, that you knew you screwed
something's
yourself.
Something's on your eye. Yeah, you know? And you're in this room thing. Doing this shit, and I realized that. And it started to change because it was all about this as well. It was like, I go to a gym. You know, I looked at pictures of me and I'm completely ripped. Like, I'm tanked, man. I'm proper tanked. I mean, Barbados, I'm ripped. I'm out to sea. I'm like James Bond. I'm walking out to sea like this. I'm just like, hold the boss. Like, I'm taking
crunch,
a shit.
Crunch, crunch.
Like, I'm taking a shit. And then I go to the gym and I'm like, is he looking now? Yeah. And I'm like, he's just holding my fucking breath. And men, we hold our breath. And I've started to learn and have been taught through that big, that really difficult.
It's about breathing,
man.
Yeah.
Holding bow. Holding bow and breathing through bow and extending through bow and just breathing and just, you know.
Like, what the fuck?
I know. And it's one of those things. And you know what? It's the effeminate. Yes, it is the effeminate. I'm sitting in a fucking pair of budgie smugglers and I'm in a room. And the thing is, I was in, when I first started doing it, my first two lessons, I walked out 20 minutes. I'm like, fuck all this shit. It's fucking bollocks, man. All this caper. Do you know what I mean? Because like, I couldn't act because my ego's like, nah, man, get out of here. You don't want to be doing this shit. And it's like when I started to be in there and it became overwhelming, the heat. Well, am I going to pass the fuck out? But then I thought to myself, what saved me was, hang on a minute, theory. When you're buzzing off your nut with your mates at a party, in that said party, yeah. And you go from the bar to the house, and it's the private, and you're in the inner sanctum of drug use, and you go to that house, and you're buzzing, you're like, have another few lines, there's some more acid, there's some more, you're like, oh my God, I'm buzzing off my tits, I'll do another one. Because you do that, you beat yourself up, and push yourself to the edge, and when you come down, that's what the yoga was like. I'd have like 10 downers hit me like, bam, and I'm coming down, and I can't leave the fucking room. I don't want to leave the room now. And it's coming out of me. And it's coming out of the joints. It's coming out of my fucking butt. It's coming out of my loins. It's coming out of my feet. It's not literally coming out. But it's all of that stuff. We keep all our shit here, man, in the hips. You know, you think about it. I brought my hand 9 fucking times. I've been fighting with this shit for years. I got stabbed in the arm fucking twice. You know, I got fucking shit in my ribs. I got this leg injury. It's all my left side. It's the effeminate side of my body.
Really? Wow, that's...
The right is the male... The left is the effeminate. Left is where your heart is. So do the math. Yeah. So that's the thing with yoga. And Yo Gangsters is a company where, you know, got some great ambassadors. We're doing the Om Yoga show this year. Stuart Gilchrist. And it's going to be great. So what are you? I mean.
You know, well, I did want to mention, you also, I was going to tie it in all clever-like, because that's what I do now, is don't laugh. I'll kick all y'all out, man. No, but you're on tour now. So how is tour, like you're doing a UK tour in the middle of it, right?
Yeah, well, I've just, well, I'm, no.
Well, you're doing festivals over the weekend,
yeah, festivals,
right?
Weekend. Yeah. But the live tour is with the Heritage Ensemble from the 14th of November to the 24th. Yeah. We just did Henley Festival the weekend.
Yeah, how'd
that go? And the crazy thing about that, before we get to the Q&A, is that we've always been chastised by the Conservative people for like ravers going out in fields. These guys were fucking nuttier than ravers. They were like, as soon as that shit starts drinking that shit and the ties are up, like, ah! It was like watching animals. They're trying to climb on the fucking stage. I'm giving someone a high five and they're like trying to get this up on the stage.
It's like crazy Victorian.
Yeah, it's some Victorian shit. And I'm like, wow. But, you know, these people haven't even heard this fucking music probably. And they wouldn't sit down. It was crazy. So we did that. We did the orchestra shows. Mm-hmm. It's a big thing to do, those shows, but it's amazing. Two dramas and a percussionist, and we go at it with a full 42-piece orchestra. And I love it, the fact that I can go and DJ with metalheads, my guys and the label, on an underground thing in Kiev. I can come back and be at Ronnie Scott's with the ensemble. I can go for Ronnie Scott's and do the orchestral show. And it's a different layers of goalies, all those layers that people thought I was mad at you. Yeah. 20 years ago, they said... He wants to orchestrate drum and bass. Fuck, he's fucking crazy. I want to do Ibiza Classics, said Pete Tong. I want to do, you know, Hacienda Classics. They're all doing it now. They're realizing that I wasn't as mad as people thought I was.
He's a Renaissance man. It's true, bro. I mean, we used to hang out all the time.
And, it's crazy.
You know, everybody's got something to say about someone who ain't in the fucking room, right? And I've noticed that a lot, right? And,
yeah, of course. And people say some shit.
Yeah, they do, but they ain't in the room anymore. Well, folks, that was some amazing stuff right there. If you've got any sense, you're already subscribed, ready, and waiting for part 2 to drop later this week. You might think there's not much left to share, but we really get into some great questions from the audience, so you don't want to miss part 2, the live Q&A with Goldie on Huey
Off the Record. Until then, stay classy.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.